From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The world's biggest sporting event will not be headed to these shores in 2022. Ahead in Only a Game, the World Cup goes to Qatar, or Qatar, or that little country near Saudi Arabia. Also, an Arizona city embraces elite Australian footballers, and distinguished documentarian Frederick Wiseman discusses his latest film, Boxing Gym. Also ahead, a conversation with Mantle biographer Jane Levy, who recalls her days interviewing the Mick.
Here I found myself stuck beneath 200 pounds of grade A American hero, passed out, dead drunk, face down in my lap.
How could you not stay tuned?
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Shall I recall the candidates? Australia, Japan, Korea, Qatar, United States of America. The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
And so the efforts of the U.S. Bid Committee to ensure that this country would become the center of the soccer world for a few weeks, 12 years hence, went for naught. Sunil Gulati, the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, did his best to appear gracious in the face of this disappointment.
We're thankful that we had the support of so many, disappointed for our fans and everyone involved in the game, whether it's professional teams, the government support that we've had, and everyone else that supported. So we're thankful for that and disappointed for them as well as us.
The U.S. hosted the World Cup in 1994. Japan and South Korea co-hosted the event in 2002. For 2022, FIFA apparently felt it had to go with youth rather than experience, which delighted Sheikh Mohammed bin Hamad Al Thani, the chairman of the Qatar Bid Committee.
Thank you for believing in change. Thank you for believing in expanding the game. Thank you for giving Qatar a chance. And we will not let you down. You will be proud of us. You will be proud of the Middle East. And I promise you this.
Plans for the 2022 World Cup now call for the construction of a number of open-air, air-conditioned desert venues, which are to be disassembled and shipped to various disadvantaged countries when it's time for the circus to leave town. U.S. fans hoping to see another World Cup on their turf were not the only ones disappointed by FIFA on Thursday. England's bid to host the party in 2018 had the official support of David Beckham and various members of the royal family, but Russia got the nod. Joining me now to comment on these events is Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Is it your impression that Sunil Gulati, the president of U.S. Soccer, former U.S. President Bill Clinton, and Nelson Mandela impersonator Morgan Freeman thought the U.S. would win this and thus were genuinely surprised by FIFA's decision?
I don't know if Sunil Gulati, the U.S. Soccer president, was surprised. Maybe Bill Clinton and Morgan Freeman. Maybe they weren't totally aware of how ruthless the politics can get in FIFA, which is a very opaque organization, as we learned again this week. Very hard to predict what they would do, and they chose two interesting candidates that not many people maybe would have chosen based on the merits.
Officials in Qatar have said the country will build 8 new air-conditioned open-air stadiums, which will be dismantled and shipped to needy countries after the World Cup is over. How much of this plan seems like a good idea?
I know that technology could advance a lot in the next 12 years, but I have a hard time seeing this being pulled off. These stadiums that are going to be tremendously futuristic with air conditioning, even though it's open air for fans and players, which they'll need for temperatures that can get as high as 120 degrees in the summer in Qatar. They've got a lot on their plate now for the next 12 years to make sure they can back up these claims, which are pretty outlandish.
Grant, there was talk before the decision about how much good winning the opportunity to host the World Cup in 2022 would have done Major League Soccer. Will the failure of the U.S. bid hurt pro soccer here?
It's a real missed opportunity because this would have been something to point toward for the next 12 years for the league to get new investors and sponsors and really start to rally not just the soccer community here, but the sports community around this league and where it's going. And I don't think it's going to doom MLS by any means, but I think it's going to make their work longer, maybe a little bit harder to become more a part of the daily sports conversation.
On the outrage meter, folks in England, which lost out to Russia in a bid to host the 2018 World Cup, appear to measure considerably higher than people in the U.S. I wonder, is this just because soccer matters so much more in Great Britain, or is it because the Brits really were sure they would win?
If you look at the betting lines in the UK, they had England as the favorite to win, and to go out first is a tremendous humiliation, much like Chicago was humiliated by going out first in the Olympic bid last year. So the English-speaking countries got varying degrees of humiliation yesterday. You had the United States not being able to beat Qatar, a country the size of Connecticut. You had England going out in the first round with only two votes, and you had Australia going out first in the 2022 bid process and only getting one vote.
The choices of Russia and Qatar have led to charges that FIFA's judges pay less attention to which countries might be the most appropriate hosts than they do to various other variables, such as money. I don't want to ask you exactly if you feel that FIFA is corrupt, but how corrupt is FIFA?
It's out there, and they certainly didn't help that perception by choosing Russia and Qatar this week, whose bids were judged to be risky by FIFA's own inspectors. FIFA puts out a pretty big charade of going through all this long process of asking for 1,000-page bid books and sending out inspection teams to write reports on the merits of each bid country, and yet you get the sense they don't even read any of those things, that it comes down to 22 old men in a room in Zurich who would probably be pretty well suited for playing on Survivor. These guys are some of the more ruthless politicians you'll ever run into, and it's a pretty opaque process.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he has just returned from Zurich, where FIFA delighted soccer fans in Russia and in Qatar. Grant, thanks very much for speaking with me. In October, the Collingwood Magpies won their first Australian Rules Football Championship in 20 years, and it wasn't easy. The first match ended in a draw, so the Pies, as they're affectionately known, had to play again a week later. They won that game by a record 56 points. Collingwood players and coaches credit their victory in no small part to training in the mountains of northern Arizona, halfway around the world from their seaside home in Melbourne. Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker has our story.
The city of Flagstaff, Arizona, is perched 7,000 feet high. It's only a two-hour drive from Phoenix, but nearly a mile higher in elevation. The cool alpine air here has attracted world-class swimmers and runners for decades. But late last month, the city welcomed some very different athletes. The Collingwood Magpies sprint around the field inside the Sky Dome on the campus of Northern Arizona University, barking out instructions to one another. Australian Rules Football, or footy, is sort of a cross between soccer, football, and rugby. The players tackle hard, without any helmets or pads. They run fast, and they run really far, as much as 12 miles in a single game. Star player Scott Pendlebury says training in Flagstaff has really paid off.
Yeah, I think it's been building over a few years, and last year we seemed to be able to maintain our fitness in the latter part of the season, which was really important.
Collingwood has trained in Flagstaff five of the past 6 years. The other year, the team practiced at altitude in South Africa. Head coach Mick Malthouse says it may be coincidence.
For the 6 years we've done it, we've been in the finals, so we'll take it that it's the altitude.
The basic science behind high-altitude training is pretty simple. Because the air at higher elevations is thinner, every breath delivers less oxygen to the muscles, so the body compensates by producing more red blood cells.
there's no doubt in our mind that the altitude itself is, it's a quicker way of getting the fitness levels up.
Which means the team can spend a lot more time on the technical aspects of the game, like ball work and tactics. Coming to Flagstaff was the brainchild of David Buttefint, Collingwood's director of sports science. He first came here in 2000 with the Australian swim team right before the Sydney Olympics. That team went on to win 17 medals, and Buttefint was hooked on high-altitude training.
So what we've found is that at altitude, it takes us probably only two weeks to achieve. It would probably take around about 3, maybe 4 weeks at sea level.
But maybe even more important, says Buttefint, is the mental toughness that high-altitude training fosters.
I think one of the great benefits of altitude, too, is that stress, you know, that actual physiological stress, but also the psychological stress. Knowing how to kind of cope with that kind of adversity when they're training, I think, you know, putting the players through that kind of adversity, they develop, you know, real resilience.
Which is essential during the Australian rules football season that lasts from March to October. And the players met plenty of adversity in northern Arizona. On a hike to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and back, the team's doctor broke his leg. And during a trek to the top of Arizona's highest peak, Mount Humphreys, team captain Nick Maxwell almost lost some of his teammates.
Yeah, we had a couple of guys who were genuinely close to getting blown away, I suppose. So yeah, we literally crawled hands and knees, face nose against the rocks, up for the last sort of 200 metres, which was an experience in itself.
And now that Collingwood has also reached the top of the Australian Football League, other teams are emulating their training strategies. Sean Anthony, who runs a company that helps bring elite teams to Northern Arizona, says other Australian clubs are now training in Park City, Utah, in New Zealand, and here in Flagstaff. He says if your sport requires endurance and you're not using training at high elevation, chances are you're losing out to your competition.
Because pretty much any high-level endurance athlete anywhere in the world is going to be incorporating some form of altitude training. So, you know, we see a lot of swim teams, we see a lot of runners, cyclists, triathletes, those kinds of sports. And just now are starting to see more field sports like Collingwood that have an endurance component.
That's music to the ears of a small city like Flagstaff that benefits from the out-of-town spending. In fact, Mayor Sarah Pressler was so proud of the Pies, she issued a proclamation declaring the last 2 weeks of November the Collingwood Football Club days in Flagstaff. But not before she made them sing the team song. For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker in Flagstaff.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. If wide receiver Stevie Johnson had held on to the ball thrown to him in the end zone in overtime on Sunday, the Buffalo Bills would have beaten the Steelers. But he didn't hold on to the ball, and after the game, which Buffalo lost, Johnson's buttery fingers tweeted as follows: "I praise you 24/7, many exclamation points, and this is how you do me, many more exclamation points. You expect me to learn from this, many question marks. How, many more question marks. I'll never forget this, ever. Thanks, though." There is no record of a reply, perhaps because there's nobody selling blackberries up yonder. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a new biography of the kid from Spavinaw, Mickey Mantle. But first, here with some good hot stove talk is ESPN's Tim Kirkchin. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Derek Jeter turned down a 3-year, $45 million offer from the Yankees. He was originally seeking a longer deal that would pay him more than $20 million a year. There are signs, however, that he may be willing to bend in that regard. Is there any way those two sides don't come to an agreement that would keep Jeter a Yankee for life?
I don't see it. I think he's going to be a Yankee for life. I don't think there's any way around that. He's got more hits than any Yankee in history. He's the Yankee captain. He's got 5 World Series championship rings with the Yankees. It's the only team he's ever wanted to play for since he was 8 years old. They want him. He wants them. It's just a matter of getting to the right price. It has been more contentious than I ever imagined it could be, but I think they've got this thing going in the right direction to the point where it's going to get done, which was, to me at least, inevitable all along.
The Texas Rangers are currently courting free agent pitcher Cliff Lee, as are the New York Yankees. Boy, it must be tough to be wooed by the American League finalists, both of which have lots and lots of money to offer.
Right, and I think the Yankees are going to win that bid ultimately because, as always, they have the most money to deal with. However, do not count out the Rangers in this scenario. They are the defending American League champions. They have a very good young team that probably will be even better next year. They have an emerging fan base now in a very large area of the country, and they've got more money to deal with in that organization than they have in a long time. Plus, Cliff Lee really enjoyed his time there last year. So you can't count the Rangers out, but if it comes down to money, you never bet against the Yankees. They will give Cliff Lee the best opportunity to win for the next 5 or 6 years, and I think that's what he's very interested in besides the money.
The mighty Red Sox made their own bold move this week by signing catcher Jason Varitek to a 1-year, $2 million deal. Take that, Yankees, huh?
You know, the Red Sox are in a little trouble here, Bill. They expected or they had hoped to re-sign Victor Martinez, and the Tigers jumped in and gave him 4 years for $52 million, which I think surprised a lot of us. And now the Red Sox, who were one hitter down last year, are now 2 hitters down. And Jason Varitek is not going to fill that void by any means, but he's still a well above average defensive catcher. But they're going to have to go get, and he's not going to be able to catch every day either. They have to go out and get 2 more hitters. One is going to be Adrian Beltre, I believe, to re-sign and play third base, and then they're going to put the full court press on Carl Crawford and see if they can get him in to play left field.
In the National League, the Colorado Rockies signed shortstop Troy Tulowitzki to a new contract that guarantees over $157 million over the next 10 years. Are we back in the 90s?
It sure seems that way, Bill. However, with a select few guys out there, a 10-year deal is maybe not a bargain, but it's a good idea. And in this case, that's who Troy Tulowitzki is. He is not a good player. He is a great player. And we saw that down the stretch last year. He also loves the game as much as anyone you'll ever meet, meaning he's not going to get complacent or heavy and not be able to play shortstop in 2 years. Now, again, there's a danger when you're going to be paying a shortstop this kind of money when he's 36 years old. But at the same time, to lock him up and not have to worry about him and build your club around him for 10 years, that's a really good idea.
The White Sox would appear to have improved themselves dramatically with the signing of slugger Adam Dunn to a 4-year, $56 million deal. Will Chicago be good enough to be a contender?
I think so, Bill, but they still have a lot of work to do. They're still trying to re-sign Paul Konerko, who's their first baseman from last year, and that way they could have Dunn and Konerko in their lineup in the middle, and they could alternate those two at first base and at DH, which would be a great idea, especially since Dunn is not a particularly good defensive player. However, they also have to address their bullpen if they're going to win that division next year. And they're not sure who their closer is at this point. So as long as they understand that Rafael Soriano, another free agent, is out there and he's better than what we have, if they go in that direction, they may be the team to beat in that division.
Now that Dunn is gone, does Washington have anybody who isn't a pitcher to help keep the Nationals out of the National League East cellar and help draw some people to that ballpark?
You know, I'm worried about the Nationals, Bill. I mean, without Steven Strasburg for 2011 and Adam Dunn, who was such a fan favorite, I'm not sure why people or if people are going to come to the ballpark next year. That club is not going to be very good. Their starting pitching is weak at this point, and they lost their second-best hitter behind Ryan Zimmerman and the guy who protected Zimmerman in the order. They basically told me all along, we offered him 3 years, we're not going four. If someone goes four, we're going to lose him. Well, the White Sox went four, and now the Nationals are in trouble again because they don't have anybody at this point to replace him.
Tim, we would be remiss not to remember at this point Ron Santo, who passed away on Thursday, longtime Cubs infielder and even longer time Cubs broadcaster. Do you have some good Ron Santo stories for us?
Well, first off, he's a Hall of Famer for me, even though he's not in the Hall of Fame. For a 10-year period, averaged 26 homers and 100 RBIs back when that really meant something. Made 9 All-Star teams and won 5 Gold Gloves. But more than that, I'm not sure there's ever been anyone that loved the Cubs more than Ron Santo as a player and then as a lovable broadcaster and an ambassador to the team. And when I talked to him a couple years ago, one day in spring training, he just sat there and he told me, he said, I just wish that every fan in Chicago or any baseball fan could have experienced one day what I experienced for almost 15 years, and that's running out on the field at Wrigley Field before a packed crowd in the daylight and playing third base in a major league game for the Chicago Cubs. He said, I was lucky to do that so many times. I wish our fans could just do it once to understand what a great thing it was.
Tim Kirchen is a reporter for ESPN's Baseball Tonight and a senior writer for ESPN the magazine. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
Of Mickey Mantle, the ballplayer, Casey Stengel once said, "This kid ain't logical. He's too good. It's very confusing." At his best, Mantle stunned even his teammates with his prowess, and at his worst, he was an embarrassment to himself, his family, his friends, and his fans. In The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, author Jane Levy maintains that Mantle as a phenomenon transcended both extremes. She joins me now from NPR in Washington. Jane Levy, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, I can't imagine any place I'd rather be.
Oh, that's very nice. Your story of Mickey Mantle's life is arranged around several accounts of a particular meeting you had with him, and this is a meeting during which he passed out in your lap. Tell us about that encounter.
Well, you have to add the salient words, face down in my lap, to get the full view of it.
I thought I'd let you do that.
Well, you know, as many tragic elements as there are to this story, that was a surreal and, in retrospect anyway, funny moment because, after all, here I found myself stuck beneath 200 pounds of grade-A American hero, passed out, dead drunk, face down in my lap. I could hear the bells and whistles of the casino. It was the Claridge Hotel and Casino by that point, where he had signed on as a greeter. And the room was swirling the way the lemons would downstairs. And all I could think of is, how did Mickey Mantle end up face down in my lap? And that was the story, basically, that I set out to tell. Because when I went to Atlantic City in 83 as a reporter for the Washington Post, I couldn't write what really happened. Mm-hmm. It would have been a firing offense in 1983 to write this story. Today, Bill, it would be a firing offense not to write it.
You posit that much of what was self-destructive about Mickey Mantle can be traced to his childhood. How so?
Well, he grew up in an area called the Tri-State Mining District, Commerce, Oklahoma. It's a barren, horrid landscape, one where fatalism percolates up from the earth. It is literally undermined. People there are quite accustomed to the world collapsing beneath their feet because so much had been taken out of the ground. So Mickey came by that sense of fatality, honestly. And on top of that, there was alcoholism embedded in his DNA from his mother's side of the family, one of his aunts. There was also sexual abuse that he suffered first at the hands of his half-older sister, and that's something that Merlin Mantle, Mickey's wife, first discussed in a family memoir published a year after Mickey died in 1996. And he was not only abused by his half-older sister, but he had the experience that I presume lots of boys have of being chased down and fondled by neighborhood boys. He also had a sexual relationship with a high school English teacher. He said, that's the only way I got through high school, was by screwing the teachers. So, you know, every boundary was crossed. Mm. And it became palpable to me that it could well explain why he crossed so many boundaries of taste and decorum. And it certainly explained to Merlin his promiscuity, his taste in women, she said, his language and his treatment of women. And it also explained to her how one can be the center of attention, the center of New York, when New York was the center of the world in baseball and everything else, and still feel acutely isolated and alone.
Many of the stories that demonstrate how great a ballplayer Mickey Mantle was emphasize his power at the plate. Have you a favorite among his home run stories?
Well, I for sure the chapter about the tape measure home run, that has to be my favorite because, of course, it's integral to the creation of the myth of the Mick. And what happened was that Chuck Stobbs, a lefty for the Senators, threw him a ball, he wailed into it, and he hit it over the 32 rows of concrete bleachers in left field at Griffith Stadium. And that ball's had gone out of the ballpark before off Ruth's bat and Dobie's, but only to right and right center field, not as far. Well, the ball kicked off the edge of a scoreboard and disappeared into the neighborhood, an area called LaDroite Park. And Red Patterson, according to legend, perpetuated largely by himself, stood up and said, that one's got to be measured, and charged off after the ball. And when he returned with a tattered baseball, he also came back with a tail. And what he said was that he met a young boy named Donald Dunaway, who took him to the spot at 434 Oakdale Place, and he gave him the ball in exchange for, depending on which paper you read the next morning, 75 cents, a dollar, $5, $10. And Red returned with this and the miraculous number 565. Well, it took me 3 years, Bill, but I found Donald Dunaway. I had to hire two private eyes to find him, including a guy who's an FBI profiler who found Kanzai in Pakistan after 5 years. And he told me this guy's harder to find than Kanzai. He lived 2 miles from where the stadium used to stand, and he told me the story from his point of view. He never took anybody anywhere. He said, I never gave them the address 434 Oakdale Place. I just said it landed behind one of those houses on Fifth Street.
Yogi Berra's wife, Carmen, told you that even at the top of his game, Mickey Mantle was a danger to himself and, quote, he loathed himself. Does that strike you as overstatement?
No, it really doesn't. Sadly, I wish it were overstatement. I think that he was powerless to stop himself from his most self-destructive tendencies. It was a liquid time in America. Everybody had won for the road, if not four. I've wondered, Bill, recently, if there had been smartphones at the Copacabana and people had documented and post it on YouTube within seconds, the shenanigans that went down in what was lovingly called the fracas at the Copa, would Mickey Mantle have been better off? If Mickey's recklessness, the kind of stuff that has in recent days and weeks and months caught up with Tiger Woods and Brett Favre and God knows how many athletes, if there had been a check and balance in technology, would he have been forced to come to grips with some of these things earlier? I think that's possible.
I'm speaking with Jane Levy, the author of The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, and you're listening to Only a Game. The standard evaluation of Mickey Mantle has always been, had he not torn up his knee at the very beginning of his career, or had he paid attention to rehabilitating himself instead of spending so much time in places like the Copacabana and other bars, he would have been even better. But you quote one of Mantle's teammates, Cleet Boyer, as saying, how much better could he have been? It's a great question, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an impossible question to answer. He had what we call the unhappy tri-hat. He blew out his knee, ACL, MCL, torn cartilage, and he didn't have surgery until 2 years later. Even by playing, he was making it worse. So, yeah, he should have rehabbed better. Sure, he should have taken better care of himself in so many ways. But it wasn't all willful neglect that caused this. And the other thing that's true, and I really wanted to focus on the Willie, Mickey, and the Duke debate because it occupied so much of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
My dad being a Willie guy who grew up on Coogan's Bluff and who tormented me with a daily box score. You know, when you take all the new stats, all those fancy morps and warps and vorps, and when you measure Mantle retroactively, he does extraordinarily well.
Toward the end of his life, Mickey Mantle found sobriety, and one of the doctors who treated him during his rehab said that he had displayed a syndrome called, I'm quoting now, acquired situational narcissism. Is it fair to say that the high esteem in which he was held by his fans played a big part in Mantle's narcissism and ultimately his self-destruction?
I think it is, and I think it pertains to celebrities across the board. You know, Phil Lynn said to me a great thing. He said he watched Mickey in the locker room at Yankee Stadium. Phil was, of course, a rookie infielder with the Yankees in 62. And he said he watched the way the other players talked to him, what he called the loneliness of greatness. You're so isolated. All people want is to tell you about the time they saw you hit the ball off the right field facade. They don't ask, how are you? They don't really want to know, who are you? They know who they want you to be. And Phil said, you know, after watching that, he didn't want to be great.
Jane Levy is the author of The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood. The book is published by HarperCollins, and the author joined me from NPR in Washington. Jane, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, I will come back and talk to you anywhere, anytime.
I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
You know who, the fellow with the celebrated swing. Oh, I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at Nuance.com. This is NPR.
The red swimming trunks worn by members of the Singapore men's water polo team at the Asian Games feature the white crescent moon of the country's flag. Given how skimpy racing bathing suits are, I mean, where was that moon bound to rise? Perhaps the designers of the uniform should have anticipated a problem, but they didn't. As a result, the suits have been characterized as nauseating and disgraceful by readers of Singapore's Straits Times. Since the rules state that athletes must compete in the uniforms presented at the start of the competition, the water polo players are stuck with what they've got, though the head of public relations has said the trunks' design, quote, would be tweaked when the team returns home, presumably after the athletes take them off. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. A hard-working documentary filmmaker turns his attention to sports. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Thursday night, LeBron James returned to Cleveland, where the Heat squeaked by the Cavaliers by about 30 points. LeBron was rattled by all those haters in the Cleveland seats, huh?
I semi-sympathize. I really do. But about the third quarter the other night, I went from saying, hey, the Cavs win this game, it'll be a great story, to LeBron, get 90 and win by 150. I am so tired of hearing people in Cleveland complain. If you want a friend, get a dog. If you want loyalty, get a really old dog, okay? The city of Seattle lost its entire NBA team, and it lost it because it was owned by a guy who took a quick buck from a city full of feed salesmen. And we didn't get 8 solid months of national moaning about the poor people in Seattle. Your Fifi's got hurt. I'm sorry. You know what? Get over it.
At the beginning of the NBA season, a lot of smart people, allegedly smart people, projected that the Lakers might win 70 games this time around. That's not looking very likely. Which is worse, the Lakers' recent play or the Grinch shoes that Kobe Bryant will apparently be wearing on Christmas Day when they play the Heat?
Well, it's funny because I'm looking at a picture of these shoes, and it looks like somebody took a photograph and just drew on it with green Sharpie.
You may be revealing a radio secret.
Oh, so this is something Karen Given did.
The New Jersey.
Are they actually green?
They okay. are. They're Grinch-like.
All right. People shouldn't wear green shoes. Can we move on now?
The New Jersey Nets announced.
Kill me in better on this stuff, will
you? The New Jersey Nets announced on Thursday that their team website is now available in Russian. Pochemi. That means why in Russian.
Спасибо. Da. Huh. Why? Because somewhere in there, I guarantee you, there's a bookie service. I am loving this new owner of the Nets. I really am.
In the only NHL news worth reporting this week, Charlie, Mark Savard played for the Bruins on Thursday night after missing the first 23 games of the season due to post-concussion syndrome. Good to see him back on the ice.
It was good to see him back, and the Bruins responded by scoring 8 goals. So, you know, at least they felt good about having him back.
The NFL announced this week that fans holding tickets to games that are not played due to a 2011-2012 work stoppage would receive refunds. Is this a grand and generous gesture, or did the lawyers working for the owners just fail to come up with a legal loophole that would have allowed them to keep everybody's money with no games?
I think a lot of both of them are true, but I think the other thing this indicates is they're going to get around very quickly to hiring scabs again.
Steelers linebacker James Harrison was fined $25,000 on Tuesday for a hit he put on Bills quarterback Ryan Fitzpatrick. Actually, have we reached the point where James Harrison getting fined for hitting somebody isn't news anymore?
This is his fourth fine this year for a total of $125,000. If the league thinks he's this bad, isn't it time for him to lose a couple of games?
Fans there, by the way, are taking up a collection for him because, my goodness, I don't know how else he's ever going to come up with a 25 grand.
Because Americans are idiots, Bill. Let's skip down. I have a book I can recommend, by the way, on that subject.
Auburn quarterback Cam Newton, whose father apparently tried to shop him to Mississippi State, was ruled ineligible and then eligible almost before we could spell ineligible. What happens next week?
I don't know, but I'm sure Reverend Grabitall and his various business partners have probably already have the Heisman Trophy up on eBay. The kid hasn't even won it yet. This is the NCAA being utterly absurd. They need this guy. They want Auburn in the national championship game. This kid's on his way to the Heisman Trophy. The fact that he was for sale for the better part of 2 years doesn't count anymore.
Ohio State University President E. Gordon G. said this week, and I'm quoting, "I have no business talking about college football." By my count, that made him about the 300 millionth person to reach that perfectly correct conclusion. But what caused the scales to drop from his eyes?
Well, apparently he took a lot of heat for saying that the teams in the BCS championship game should generally all come in perpetuity from large conferences like the one his school plays in. And people got very offended by this whole thing, and people don't like the BCS anyway. And I agree, by the way, he should never be talking about college football ever again.
I have great sympathy for President G because I have no business talking about college football, and yet I do it every once in a while.
That's only because I'm sitting here making you.
Given the fact that the U.S. bid to host the World Cup failed and that the games went to Qatar, is it fair to say that Morgan Freeman, a.k.a. Nelson Mandela's clout, has been seriously overestimated?
How about Bill Clinton was also on with the bid committee?
Hey,
listen, Bill, I bow to you on all things soccer. You know that. But there is one thing I am an expert on, and that's playing soccer in Qatar. Because I was actually there in 1993 for the Asian Zone qualifying. Phil Bondi of the New York Daily News and I were the only two American reporters there watching. I can tell you, first of all, don't rent a car. You won't need one. Second, everything you know, you've heard about the Heat is an understatement. And third, you can get a drink if you really want to. When you check into your hotel, they ask you if you want a library card. Say yes.
Former third baseman and Cubs announcer Ron Santo died this week, Charlie. In recent years, he had fallen just short of being elected to the Hall of Fame by the Veterans Committee. You care to make a case for his inclusion at this point?
I mean, I think outside of Mike Schmidt, he was the best third baseman of his time, all-around third baseman, and I include Brooks Robinson.
That should be enough.
Well, for me, but not for the Hall of Fame voters. Although this, I would almost guarantee you, will be one of those deals where everybody feels so bad they vote him in now.
There is evidence this week that trying to sign Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera to the New York Yankees is not a full-time job. Would you care to tell us what Yankees GM Brian Cashman will be doing tomorrow afternoon?
Yes, he'll be going nuts, Bill. he's going to rappel down the side of a 350-foot building in Connecticut as part of Stanford's Heights and Lights event as, and I'm not making this up, this is his official title for the event, a celebrity guest elf.
Yeah.
What can possibly go wrong?
Oh, what a question.
Although if I were Mr. Cashman, I would check my rigging and look around the roof for any signs of a member of the Steinbrenner family.
And finally, Charlie, in the wake of last weekend's big football game between Alabama and Auburn, the University of Alabama fired the guy who was in charge of picking songs to play over the PA system during that game. What did the guy do, play some X-rated stuff or something?
Well, we spoke about Cam Newton and his father, Reverend Gimme Mine, earlier in the show. This guy decided he would have a little fun, and he played the Steve Miller Band's Take the Money and Run and Dusty Springfield's Son of a Preacher Man. Now, let's all be fair about this. If this kid went to Duke, he'd have a full scholarship by the next day.
He'd probably have a degree in his mailbox.
I don't know when Alabama got so fussy.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, the book about which he was speaking a few minutes ago. And he joins me each week at this time on Only the Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
And I am the permanent celebrity guest elf.
The interesting things about the gym for me was that was the class mixture, because there are people, upper class, middle class, lower class, whoever those vague words, but people from all classes, and they got along. Everybody got along.
Frederick Wiseman, who has been making documentary films since 1966, spent about 100 hours in Lord's Gym in Austin, Texas, filming his most recent documentary titled Boxing Gym. He was particularly impressed by the concern those in the ring and outside it expressed for each other.
I mean, and there's one point in the gym where a young boxer says to a newcomer at the gym, you know, we all try to help each other out here, and even though it's a violent sport, nobody can be violent unnecessarily. We all try to cooperate and collaborate.
I spoke with Frederick Wiseman recently in his Cambridge, Massachusetts studio, which is cluttered with canisters of film, posters for various movies, and a lot of awards. Mr. Wiseman cheerfully acknowledged that he began this project with a general feeling that he liked boxing. He became fond of the man who owns and runs the Texas gym, Richard Lord, and admired Lord's inclination to welcome anybody who was interested in training there, an inclination that's apparent throughout the movie. There were a lot of kids in there, and not just kids boxing. There were babies in this film, people who brought their little tiny babies in little chairs, and they sat and slept while Mommy worked out.
Right. Well, I mean, that's part of the attitude that Richard Lord fostered among the people who came to the gym. You come, you know, bring your baby, keep an eye on your baby, and work out if you want. In that case, it was practically a newborn.
Of course, not everyone in this film is counting on the gym for child care. From time to time, Wiseman's all-seeing camera finds somebody whose presence seems less surprising.
I love getting hit in the chin, dude, getting buzzed. I love being buzzed. Put my hands up and coming with that right. Boom, landed one right there, backing them off, you know?
Right.
Love taking one right across the chin. I
love
the buzz.
I love coming out of here and feeling like I've done something different, you know, something new. That's good.
I just like the buzz it gives you, because you don't know quite where you are, but you know you got to fight to get out of where you are.
Of course there's a point of view, and there is a directorial point of view. These movies are made, in a sense, in the reverse way of Hollywood movies. Hollywood movie, or normal fiction movie, you start with a script, and you shoot the script. And while there may be some improvisation or some variation from the script, in my movies, I go in with absolutely no script. But over the course of anywhere from 4 to 12 weeks, shoot anywhere from 75 to 150 hours. And I find the film in the editing. There's the old bromide about the sculptor finding the statue under the stone. I find the film under the rushes. it's almost musical. In fact, it is musical. I mean, the whole sound of the gym is musical.
And
I tried to preserve that in the editing of the film.
At Lord's Gym, Frederick Wiseman found the percussion of gloves against the heavy bag and the staccato rhythm of the speed bag, the shuffle and stride of shadow boxers, and the grunts and gasps of people getting into shape, or trying to do that, or fooling themselves into thinking it could happen again. Some of Wiseman's audience will be surprised at how little actual boxing occurs during the film.
The people you see in the movie are people that like boxing as a sport and like the training, the physical training that's involved in boxing. And once a week at the gym, there was sparring. And you see at the end of the film people sparring, and the sparring is a bit more violent than the shadow boxing, obviously.
Much more violent. In fact, there's one particular sequence where a guy really gets rocked. They have helmets on in the sparring, but a guy really gets rocked with a shot to the head. And I was watching it all by myself at my home, and I went, yay, when I saw that.
Yeah, well, because that's the first time in the film anybody really gets hit. And so you because he gets, it's hard, and you're surprised by it, you feel the hit.
Over the past 44 years, during which he has made 36 documentaries, Frederick Wiseman has maintained the same patient and disciplined approach to his work. Each film is different, of course, but he's found that one particular theme has surfaced as many of the films have revealed themselves during his editing process. His first documentary, Titicut Follies, presented the day-to-day routines of a hospital for the criminally insane in Bridgewater, Massachusetts.
Titicut Follies is about people who have committed the most violent acts imaginable, or many of the people at Bridgewater had. Law and Order is about, which is a film about the Kansas City police, it's about how the police try to contain and control violent behavior. Juvenile Court is a film about adolescents who have committed deviant or violent acts gets punished. Domestic violence is obviously domestic violence between people. And then the military films, Basic Training, Maneuver, and Missile, are about the state's monopoly of violence in the service of protecting the interests of the state. So one aspect of boxing is that it's ritualized and controlled violence.
Some of Frederick Wiseman's films have been controversial. Titicut Follies was banned in Massachusetts for 25 years, allegedly for violating the privacy of its subjects. Wiseman says it was because of worries that it would embarrass the people who'd granted him permission to make the film. But Boxing Jim is not likely to outrage or embarrass anyone involved. It doesn't feel like an expose, but rather like an exploration of the complexity of a culture in which aggression is less apparent than cooperation, and in which the ambitions of those who feel they're on the way up are contrasted with the delusions of those who fail to accept that their most glorious days are behind them.
I think if I train consistently, keep on working hard, I could get him in the future, no problem.
That's exactly what I told Rich Lloyd. I want to fight my opponent, man. The guy I lost to, the last guy I lost to.
Uh-huh.
Oh, lost.
There's a lot of fantasy, and a lot of, I'm really going to do it tomorrow. It's like the characters in The Iceman Cometh. That is sad. I found it sad. And everybody's going to become a world champion tomorrow, or beat the guy that beat you 3 years ago. And it's sad, it's sustaining, and you have, at least I had this sense that it's never going to happen.
Despite the depiction of that sadness, Richard Lord, who tells all potential clients that Lord's Gym operates strictly on a cash up front basis, was happy with the film.
He and his wife and his son came up here as soon as I finished the movie, and I showed it to them, and they liked it, which of course pleases me.
I wonder if he's going to get a gigantic rush of interest, people pounding on the door, say, hey, I want to come in here too. He's going to have to take plastic if he's not careful.
I think he's capable of dealing with whatever happens.
When I asked Frederick Wiseman whether he feels empty or let down after he's finished the months and months of editing his films require, he smiled and acknowledged that he did. But he told me that since he began making films in 1966, he's never paused for long.
Yeah, there's always postpartum depression. But once I became aware of it, I started planning the next film 2 or 3 months before I thought I was going to finish the one I'm working on, so that I can take a short break and go skiing or something and then get started again. Because I like to work, and it's true, because you work very, very intensely and long hours, and then suddenly it's over. So it's good to both take a break, and it's good, particularly for me, to have something else to do right away.
So what is the next project?
The next project is a movie about a nightclub in Paris, which I'm in the midst of editing at the moment.
Terrible hard work, but somebody has to do it.
Somebody has to do it, that's right.
Boxing Jim, which has been showing in selected theaters this fall, will be screened today in Rochester, New York, and at the DeBartolo Performing Arts Center on the campus of Notre Dame University. Next week, you can catch it in Hartford, Connecticut, Columbus, Ohio, or Jackson, Mississippi. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern, and we had help this week from Paul Vikas, Jim Kiesling, and Jared Mooney. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Frederick Wiseman, who remembers his idea for a follow-up to Titicut Follies.
And it seemed to me that a logical follow-on to a prison for the criminally insane was a high school.
Yeah, but how did he know so much about what it was like for me in high school? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.